Welcome to Questions from the Audio Road. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford, and I'll be taking your calls and answering your questions for the next hour or so. Lisa is here with us, screening calls and keeping things light and fun. If you want to join in, simply press 1 on your phone, and Lisa will be right with you. This is the show that puts the money where it belongs, back in your pocket. Sit back, relax, and listen, or jump in and ask your question. You can even bring us your opinion. It's up to you. This is your show. You can ask questions about fuel mileage, tires, engine, EGR, aerodynamics, truck specking, maintenance, taxes, financial planning, getting started as an owner-operator, or anything else about the business of trucking. Here we go. Let's head on down the audio road.
Hi, this is Lisa. Remember to talk to Kevin. Press 1 so I can pick up the phone and screen your calls. You know you'd rather talk to me anyway. Or just sit back, relax, and listen to the show. And at any time you have a question, just hit 1 and I'll pick up the phone.
Test 1, 2. Testing 1, 2. All right, here we go.
Your money, your taxes, your truck, your road to success in the trucking industry. This is Trucking Business and Beyond, the show that puts the money where it belongs. Back in your pocket.
Welcome to the program. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford. The number to join us, 8888 Road Dog. The website is letstruck.com. The show is all about the business of trucking. If you've got questions about trucks, money, fuel mileage, maintenance, tires, taxes, technology, or anything else you want to talk about, pick up the phone, give me a call. I'll do my best to get you an answer. I'm going to get to those calls right now. Let's start off in Iowa. Chuck, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin. How you doing?
Chuck, are you with me?
Yeah, I'm here.
Let's try Maryland. Mike, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin, can you hear me? Hello? Hello?
Okay, let's try this. Chuck, are you there in Iowa?
Yep, I'm here. I got you, Kevin. I can hear you.
How about Mike in Maryland?
I'm here, and I can hear Chuck, too.
All right, everybody, I think I've got it figured out. Give me one more minute. Your money, your taxes, your truck, your road. Your money. Your taxes, your truck, your road to... Your money, your taxes, your truck, your road to success in the trucking industry. This is Trucking Business and Beyond, the show that puts the money where it belongs. Back in your pocket. Your money, your taxes, your truck, your road to success in the trucking industry. This is Trucking Business and Beyond, the show that puts the money where it belongs. Back in your pocket. Welcome to the program. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford. The number to join us, 8888 Road Dog. The website is letstruck.com. The show is all about the business of trucking. If you've got questions about trucks, money, fuel mileage, maintenance, tires, taxes, technology, or anything else you want to talk about, pick up the phone, give me a call. I'll do my best to get you an answer. We're going to get to those calls right now. We're going to start off in Iowa. Chuck, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin. How you doing?
Doing great. What's on your mind today?
I am going to replace four of my drive tires because I've nails and I didn't catch a shock soon enough, so it ruined one. Got the Michelin Energies. I can't get a hold of the Energy Ds. They're just in short supply. And is it the Bridgestone 710 that is the equivalent?
Pretty close, yeah. The 710's a good tire. It's a drive tire with low rolling resistance, right around 99. Same as the Ds are pretty close. They're all within a couple points of each other. So, yeah, it's a good alternative.
Okay, great. And so should I put the new tires on the rear axle or the front axle?
On your particular truck, which ones tend to wear faster?
It looks like the front axle.
Okay. Yeah, I would just, you know, if the tires have been on there the same amount of time, I would stick them and see what the tread depth is, and wherever the lowest tread depth is, that's where you want to put the newer ones. It's not going to matter much, but I would put them on the axle that tends to wear faster.
Okay, yeah, I got these Michelin Energies on here, and I've got 200,000 out of them, and five of them are only about half gone. So I've been really happy with them.
Yeah, that sounds good. Like I say, you might want to look around. You may still find some of the Energies. I know the Ds are hard to find, but if not, that 710's a good tire.
Okay, and my other question is I'm scheduled an appointment to take my truck into Detroit to have some maintenance done. I'm going to have the top end reset, the charge air cooler tested, the EGR cooler looked at. Anything else for some preventive maintenance you would recommend?
How many miles do you have on it?
527.
It's time for a crankshaft damper.
Okay, it's a DD15.
Yeah, time for a crankshaft damper. They're all the same. They last roughly 500,000 miles or about 4 or 5 years.
Okay, so crankshaft, damper, and then that's about it. Should be good?
Yep, that'll do it.
Okay, great. Thank you so much, Kevin.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call. Let's head off to Georgia. Tony, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin. Thank you for taking my call. I bought a truck back in February 24th, to be exact. And at the time, the gentleman didn't have the title to it. So we had signed the bill of sale. I gave him a copy. I took the copy, and he let me drive home with his plate on the truck. And the agreement was that once I sent him his plate back and sent him pictures of the decals removed on the truck, that he would go ahead and, you know, send me the title. Well, a week after that, I had done that and sent him his plate and pictures of the decals removed. And a week had gone by, and I tried contacting him with no response. So I'd say it was probably about a week after that, I just kept calling him. We finally answered the phone, and he said he can't find a title, that he was going to go look in stores over the weekend for it. Well, Monday rolls around, and I contacted him again, and he said he couldn't find it, so he had to go apply for a duplicate title.
Okay.
So I waited another week, and, you know, the title never came in the mail, so I started calling him again. And he just still didn't answer my calls or return my texts. And it was probably about, 2 weeks ago now that he called me, and he said, well, you're going to have to pay the $1,500 to get the title of the truck. And I'm like, why?
$1,500? Where did he come up with that number?
He says that that's the amount that he owes to the person he was buying the truck from.
Now, oh, you've got to be kidding me. He didn't have a clear title on this truck?
I didn't know. You know, I've bought other trucks, you know, from dealers, you know, like that, and then they just send, you know, the title in the mail.
Right. What state are you trying to title this in?
Florida.
Have you called Florida yet to talk to them? Every state's a little different. For example, I just had to deal with the lost title on a truck in Washington, and all I needed was the bill of sale. I mean, I told them, look, I bought the truck, lost the title, but I've got a bill of sale, and there's an affidavit they have you sign, and then they issue a duplicate title. Every state's a little different, but I would call Florida, and I would explain this to them. The problem that it might be, though, is if there's a lien on that title and it still requires $1,500 to clear it, somebody's got to pay that money. Now, it should be
him. Well,
I mean, gave you a price. You paid for the truck, and he can't get the title. That's his problem. I mean, he owes the $1,500, not you, but if he won't pay it, I'm not sure what's going to happen here.
Yeah, I had called California because that's where he was from. And I called them. They said that, gave them the VIN number, and then I asked her if there was any liens on it. She said no. And I said, well, is it registered in this name or this name? And she says, well, I can't tell you that. But she said just to stop messing with him, and here's what you need to do. You know, file the for duplicate title, and then fill out the affidavit and mail a $15 in with it.
Correct.
I'm assuming that she knew that it was titled to him or his company, but she couldn't tell me, and that's why she just, you know, told me to go ahead and do this to get the title.
Right. That's what it sounds like. And that's exactly the same thing I just told you, you know, the same thing I just went through. I had a bill of sale, so it shows I was the owner, had a VIN number on there, and all I said was I lost the title. and then with an affidavit, they reissued a title.
Yeah. Well, see, he was saying that he had sent them $1,500, or sent this guy $1,500, and that was supposed to be the final payment on the truck. But when I bought the truck from him, you know, he said it was his free and clear. He even showed me his ID and the registration to it, which was, you know, registered him. So he says basically I have two options, either pay him the $1,500 and he'll pay the person, or pay the person $1,500. Now, he only gave me a bank account number for the other person to put the money in, but when I ask him for the copy of the title, he sends me a picture, you know, with only the bare information on it. He has it covered up who the registered owner is. And when he sent it, it had a title out of Oregon. So,
boy, this really sounds.
I don't
like
know.
A
it just, it just, yeah. And I should have known better. But my wife didn't want to go with me the next day back over there to pick the truck up because she had to work. And I mean, now I definitely learned from this.
Yeah, but it sounds like that you still have a chance from California, right? Have you done what they've asked you to do?
Now
you just have to wait to see what they say, right?
Yeah, they got, because we sent it with a tracking number, and they got the paperwork Monday. I called them today, and she didn't see anything in the system yet, so.
Okay, but you should know within a couple of days whether or not this is going to work.
Yeah, yeah. Now,
okay.
do you think it, you know, after I get the title and everything, do you think I could turn around and, you know, maybe sue him for the lost revenue?
You can, but it sounds to me like it would be a waste of time because it sounds like he doesn't even have the $1,500 to get the title. And if he can't spare $1,500, you could get a judgment against him, but then how are you going to collect?
Yeah. Well, I know he has
that's the problem.
Because, yeah.
Well, you always can. I mean, you could take him to small claims court for $1,500 and you may want to do that. I mean, this is what a disaster, and it sounds like it's because he lied. So, yeah, you could take him to small claims. Many times, though, you go to small claims, you get a judgment. It's very, very difficult to collect on judgment sometimes. Stick around. We'll be right back. You're on the Road Dog, Sirius XM 128. I'm Kevin Rothberg. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. The number to join us, 8888 Road Dog. Let's head off to Georgia. Matt, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon, Kevin.
What's on your mind today?
Well, a few weeks ago there in Louisville at the truck show, seemed to have a lot of smart people come through the booth with this miracle stuff you can dump in your tank and will give you outrageous fuel economy.
Yeah.
I wonder if those people are actually smart enough. They're using that time of the year as a sales point that, you know, they could sell it at the end of March there and everybody's fuel mileage goes up in April just because of the weather and fuel blends and all that. But,
you know, that's a good point. That's a good point. Although, I don't think they have to really think that much. because most of the people that buy this kind of stuff don't track their fuel mileage close enough to know whether it works or not. And then what happens is you get kind of the placebo effect or the fact that people don't like to be wrong. So they want to believe that they got better fuel economy. And we see that with anything. I mean, that could happen with any fuel economy device. But most things, if we've tested them enough with enough different people, we know what works and what doesn't. All my testing with additives, I still can't find a consistent fuel mileage increase. But most people that buy this stuff, you know, if they see one or two tanks out of 10 and it's better, then they feel like it's working for them. But nobody tracks it close enough to really know. But you're right. It certainly doesn't hurt when they sell a bunch of it at the Louisville show in March because everybody's fuel mileage is getting better every week right now.
Yeah. People posting on the MPG Masters every day, and I myself today had my first 9 miles to the gallon average in probably close to 6 months.
yeah, I saw that, so. And it's looking great. You know, I just spent time over the last couple weeks with Smart Truck, and we went through fuel gauges, and we found all the people who had the Smart Truck system showing it as a modification. And we took the time to go through, but the way we did fuel mileage, because of the seasons, what we did was we did year over year. So we went back and we took the month of March for people who had it on, and then we looked at their prior March. Now, you also have to go through and find out if they've done any other modifications since then, but that's a much better comparison, comparing this March to last March, than comparing March to even February, because the weather's, you know, starting to get better. So that's when we look at the numbers, we try to do the 30-day before and the 30-day after, and then we try to go back and look at the same period the prior year. And even then, you can't always tell. I mean, sometimes it's just difficult to do this. But you're right on the fuel additives. It's great timing for them.
Well, the funny thing is, you know, they come up to us at the truck show and just right off the bat tell them, you know, you're wasting your time. Don't even bother. We're not going to look at it. But they won't take no for an answer. So the other night here, I came up with a good thing. I think I'll have to print this up so we can just hand it to them. But I'll even throw this challenge out on the air. Anybody wants to do it. If you have a fuel additive you want us to try, you have to, on your own money, take a jug of your miracle stuff, go to Pittsburgh Power, have a truck put on the dyno, and you're going to have to pay for this because I will reimburse it if the product works, but that's after
right.
A dyno test. Put a truck on the dyno with whatever fuel's in it, get some numbers, dump your stuff in the tank, and if it comes out better on the dyno, at that point, I will test it on the road and see real world, and if it actually works, I will reimburse them for the dyno test and everything.
And if I found a fuel additive that I could actually say was cost-effective, that you can put this in your tank every time, and every time you do, your fuel mileage will increase enough to cover the cost of the additive, I would endorse one in a heartbeat if I could prove that one actually worked. But here's another interesting thing. I've got people approaching me with this kind of stuff all the time. They want me to, you know, endorse their product, and I have a whole bunch of them just sitting there, and I don't remember which one's which, but there's somebody on LinkedIn that keeps bugging me. It might even be that that water system I talked about, and they're claiming like 20 or 30% increase. So I sent it back to them, and I said, look, here's the thing. I said, I want to test this, but I want some dyno results first. You're claiming some pretty big improvements in emissions. Well, let's test that because I could do emissions testing now. And I want to test for horsepower and fuel mileage on the dyno. And they sent it back saying, well, you know, we don't always get the right results on a dyno. It's not the same as real world. So they're already backing off on their claims, and there are some things that won't show up on a dyno. But I can promise you, if you are claiming 20% increase in fuel economy and 30% reduction in emissions, we can test that. Those are big numbers. You know, it's one thing to say, you know, can we really tell the difference on a dyno with a muffler? Sometimes you can, sometimes you can't. You can't pick up the difference right away sometimes. But on big gains, when you're making those kind of claims, I should be able to see something on the dyno.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and that's, you know, since Pittsburgh Power got the dyno, they've tested many things and never would have guessed it, but the manifold and the turbo add about 100 horsepower.
Yeah, which is, I mean, that's amazing. And there's a number we absolutely can see. They've tested it enough times we can see it over and over and over. Some things you can't always tell, but like I say, if some of the claims that they're making are so wild that we would have to be able to see a change on the dyno, but yet they're already saying, well, you might not be able to see it. Yeah, well, then if I can't see it, you're not getting 30% improvement.
Yeah, as I say, I mean, if we got some type of results on the dyno, then it's worth testing, but until then, you know, there's no fuel additive that I want to even waste my time on.
Well, and if we come back to the physics of fuel mileage, which this is what I've learned over the years. I've learned how to evaluate stuff up front so you don't waste a lot of time testing everything because it could take you forever. So when we look at fuel additives, a couple things have to happen. Let's say I've got dirty fuel lines or injectors or whatever, and this stuff cleans up the system. Well, there might be an improvement. It might get me back to where I should have been in the first place. But if I have a fully functioning fuel system, everything's clean and functioning the way it's supposed to be, one of two things has to happen. There either has to be an awful lot of BTUs in that little bottle. There's got to be a lot of energy in there. Or what? How is it working if there isn't? You know, I know they're going to claim, well, it's going to help you burn more of the fuel and it's going to, you know, get the water out so you're burning. We might pick up a percent or two maybe, which we wouldn't be able to measure. So I don't get it. Somebody's got to explain to me how these things are even supposed to work.
Yeah, they just won't take no for an answer, and I get a kick out of it. I have fun with it sometimes, but after so long, you get annoyed by them, you know?
Oh, yeah, especially when they get nasty. You know, the guy this year got nasty about it. What I don't get is why they bother to get nasty. Look, if you're coming over and asking me for my advice or my opinion, I just gave it to you. Why do you get mad at me for my opinion? It's just my opinion. If you disagree with it, go someplace else and sell your fuel additive. I'm just not interested.
That's right. We've never told one of them you can't sell it. Just not here.
No, knock yourself out. Yeah, exactly. All right, good stuff. Well, that's a good idea, though, because we need something like that to hand to just about anybody who comes up with the shows anymore. Let's go to Alabama. Rico, welcome to the program.
Kevin, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. What's on your mind today?
Well, I've got a question about retirement accounts. I know I've always heard you guys talk about the IRAs and everything, and I have a self-directed 401k. And I was curious to find out if you knew much about those and maybe the benefits, the pros and cons of having those.
I do, as a matter of fact. And right after this break, I will come back and we'll talk all about 401ks, IRAs, retirement accounts, SEPs, POs, the list goes on and on. But we'll talk about the pros and cons. Stick around, we'll be right back. You're on the Road Dog, Sirius, XM 128. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Mm-hmm. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. The number to join us, 8888 Road Dog. I'm going to go back to Alabama. Rico, you still with me?
Yes, sir.
All right. So it's interesting that you talk about a self-directed 401k because that is what I recommend. And I have talked about it on the air, just not a lot because I don't get that many calls about retirement accounts. The 401k, the beauty of the 401k is it allows much higher contributions than an IRA. The rules are basically the same as far as how it's taxed and what you can invest in, and there aren't many differences. The difference really just comes down to how much you can contribute, and we want accounts that let us contribute as much as possible, and the 401k, I mean, depending on your earnings, you can contribute up to $20,000, $30,000 a year sometimes, which is way more than an IRA. Now, the other thing I talk about, and I need to go date my research on this because I haven't looked in a while, but there is a form of a 401k that allows you to choose how you want your contributions taxed. For example, you can either put the money in like a traditional IRA, meaning you get your tax break now, then the money grows tax-free, but at the end you're going to pay tax on everything as you take it out. Or you can choose to put the money in and have it taxed like a Roth. You don't get a tax break at all now. The money will grow tax-free, and when it comes out, it will be tax-free. That's actually the best route if you can get by without needing the tax deduction right now. The tax break is much bigger when you take it at the end instead of at the beginning. The last time I looked, the only company that I could find that would offer that type of 401k to an individual was T. Rowe Price. There might be somebody else out there now. I haven't looked in, like I say, about a year and a half, I think it was. So I need to go back and do that. But that's really, the one at T. Rowe Price was my favorite because you could contribute all kinds of money and you could pick and choose how you wanted it taxed. You could even mix and match every year. Like some could be taxed now and some could be taxed later. So it really gave a lot of flexibility.
The thing that got me thinking about this was mine, we had to have a new something about so many years you have to have it renewed or something. We had to do something, so I had documents that I had to re-sign and reorganize the one that I have right now. And that's what got me thinking about it. And I may shoot you this guy's email information that I deal with, but he said mine is through Schwab.
Okay.
Charles Schwab.
Yeah, and basically they're all the same except for that one at T. Rowe Price, the one that actually allowed you to pick and choose. I really like that one. But other than that, there really isn't much difference between them. Everybody offers the same basic funds, and, you know, the rules are all the same because the IRS sets the rules. So wherever you have it is fine.
So I just thought it would be cool for, like, owner-operators to know that option. To be able to have something like that, and also I'm a Dave Ramsey guy, so it's not something that Dave Ramsey would recommend as far as being able to borrow from your 401k, but if you're in a pinch and you needed some cash and you had some cash away.
Well, here's the thing we have to remember, though, because you'll find lots of people who will tell you not to borrow from your 401k, and there's a good reason for it. But I think they're primarily talking to people who work for somebody else. Now, Dave Ramsey probably tells everybody, don't borrow from your 401k because that's your retirement. But a lot of other financial planners will say that. I tell people not to borrow from your 401k. But if it's your own, meaning you own the account, it's not through an employer, then there's no real danger to doing it. The problem with having borrowed from an employer's account, let's say you work for somebody and they set up a 401k and you contribute, maybe they contribute some, and you go to borrow the money. Let's say you borrow 20 grand to go buy a car instead of, you know, paying finance charges to somebody else, which sounds like a great thing on the surface because you're borrowing your own money and you'll pay yourself back interest. Wonderful thing. Until you quit, get fired, the company gets sold, goes out of business, there's all kinds of things that could happen. And what happens then, let's say you borrowed 20 and it's been a year and you still owe $15,000. If you can't pay the $15,000 back immediately, it becomes taxable with penalties. Because if you can't take it back, if you can't pay it back, then they call it an early withdrawal and you end up paying all the taxes and penalties. So it's not worth the risk when somebody else owns that account. But if you have your own, there's no risk. I mean, you would never have to pay it back early. It would always be your choice just to pay it back under whatever schedule you wanted. So there isn't nearly as much risk borrowing from your own.
Okay, cool. Well, I just, like I said, I just wanted to kind of, I never got a chance to hear you talk about it on the show, and I thought it would be good to bring it out so that some more guys could know that they have that option.
Absolutely, and thanks for the call. It's a great topic. I don't get a lot of questions about it. I should probably just bring it up more often and talk about it because we are seeing now, we're seeing more and more owner-operators who need to incorporate because they're doing better. We're seeing more and more owner-operators who do have money to contribute, so maybe we will start talking about that more. Let's go to Idaho. Kevin, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin. I've got a financial question on a 401. I'm a company driver right now, and when I get ready to quit, I've got a 401k, and they match 50 cents to the dollar, and then they have profit sharing, and they're telling me that the profit sharing portion isn't vested yet, and so I will lose that money when I quit, even though they put the profit sharing money each year into my 401k.
That is correct.
They can do that. They can take that amount of profit sharing that they gave me, they can take it back.
They can. I'm assuming, since they're telling you this, I mean, it's written down somewhere. It's in the account information, and they can set a time to where you are vested, meaning they don't want to share profits with people who only work there for a year or two or three or whatever their number is. They want to use that as an incentive to keep people working there. And they're allowed to do that. The rules on 401ks allow them to. Now, their matching contributions, they can't do that. Once they make a matching contribution, that's yours. But profit sharing, they can set a time limit to when you become vested, and that means once you're vested, then that money's yours and they can't take it back. But until you are vested, the profit sharing, they can withhold.
I see. Okay. All right, well, that answers my question, and I appreciate it. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call. Let's go to Indiana. Mark, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin.
What's on your mind today?
Got an oil sample for you to look at.
All right, let's see what we've got here. Did I look at this recently?
No.
No, this is a new one.
Must have looked at it earlier today, yeah.
It's very colorful. Colorful, that's not always a good thing. So this is a Series 60. What year?
The motor is a 05 14-liter EGR.
Okay, so it is EGR. All right, so we've got 365,000 miles showing on the engine. Is that on an in-frame?
That's on an in-frame, correct.
Okay, we have 163,000 on the oil itself. Let's see what the biggest problems are here.
lead, really.
The lead is, yeah, now that I look at everything, the lead is kind of worrying me. And I don't know where the lead might be coming from. If it's bearings, and it looks like it probably is. Have you changed this oil?
No.
I would change it. It's getting
okay.
A little funky. There's so much going on. It's time
one
to just
problems,
change this and get a clean start.
Okay. One of the problems is they had it listed as just regular Shell Rotella, and it's the T6.
Yeah, and that'll affect things like viscosity, but wear metals are wear metals, and that lead climbing has got me a little worried. In fact,
could
I might
that come
even
from
recommend
an air compressor?
Well, hold that thought. I'll be right back. Stick around. You're on the Road Dog, Sirius XM 128. I'm Kevin Rothenberg. All right, everybody, quick note here. We are getting ready to start the fourth segment. End of the show is what we're recording right now. So at the end of the show, I always say, I'm done. I've got to get out of here. Good night. All that stuff. Don't hang up because we're going to come right back and record another hour. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. The number to join us, 8888 Road Dog. I'm going to go back to Indiana. Mark, you still with me?
Yep.
Yeah, I wouldn't assume that this is coming from a compressor. I don't know on that engine if that compressor has any lead components in it or not, but I wouldn't assume it, even if it did. Here's what I would recommend. I would recommend you do an oil change. Sometime soon, within the next week will be plenty. Get the oil changed. On the next sample, if we see any elevation in lead at all, I would pull the pan down and inspect the bearings. I wouldn't worry too much about it yet. It's not that high. That was a pretty big jump. Let's get some fresh oil in it, and if that lead comes back, then I would pull the pan down.
Okay.
Other than that, I mean, everything looks good. The engine's running just fine. You know, your soot levels are okay. No fuel dilution. The oil's getting a little stale because it's been in there a long time. But other than that, I freshen it up and give me a call back after the next sample, and we'll take a look at the lead and see what we should do. Let's go to Maryland. Mike, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin. Thanks for taking my call. I have an 09 EGR ISX Cummins on a T660. And I had sent you my sample one time, and it was leaking. So I took it to a reputable truck repair shop in Pennsylvania. They actually know Bruce out of Pittsburgh Power. But anyhow, they found the the EGR cooler to be the problem. So I had that replaced, but also I went ahead and did some of your recommendations, like replacing the fuel lines and putting in the OPS system from OPS. One question that I had was, how would you know if the OPS system was installed correctly? Because they didn't use all the parts, and since I don't know squat about what the system is, the other
okay.
filters are still left in there, right?
The full flow filters will always be there. We have to have those. There's a quick, easy way for you to look at it, and I can tell you a couple things you can do to verify that it's working.
Okay.
There should be one oil line running from the engine to the unit, and one oil line running from the unit back to the engine. But those two have to be there. And then there's some 12-volt wires, and that's about it. I mean, they may have left some fittings or brackets or other stuff off that they just didn't need. The other thing you can do is when the engine's running and at full temperature is feel the filter itself. The filter should be warm because the warm oil's flowing through it. And if oil's flowing through it, then it's working. And then you have your lights, you know, make sure your lights are on so the heating element's working. But that's really all there is to it. Oil flows through it, heating element comes on, and it's working. Fairly simple.
Okay, they had something that is made by Cummins. It's called a fuel pressure sensor. And they say that it fools the ECM to bring in more fuel, and it gives you more torque, and their customers actually have experienced a 0.5 to 1.5 increase in fuel savings. I don't know if you've
Hold on a second. Did you say 0.5, like a half mile per gallon? Is that what they mean?
Yes. It actually saves
all the way up to
They sell it, say 0.5 to 1.5 miles to the gallon. But it also increases the on their dyno, it increases results for horsepower up to 60 and 250 pounds of torque. That's on the dyno. But the fuel, they don't say that they experience that on the dyno. They're custom. I don't think you've come across anything called the ISX fuel pressure sensor at all.
Yeah, I there's so many things out there like this. Most of them don't come anywhere near to what they're claiming. You know, just putting more fuel into the cylinder may or may not. It can certainly help with horsepower and torque. It doesn't necessarily help with fuel economy. And I can guarantee you nobody got a mile and a half per gallon improvement from this. Half mile per gallon might be a stretch. A mile and a half, absolutely not. Not going to happen.
If I get half a mile, that's good enough. It's fairly inexpensive. It's like $200. So
if you get a couple tenths, it would be worth it. I don't know. How long has it been on there?
2 days. I got it back.
Let me know. If you're tracking your fuel mileage close. Good. Yeah, let me know, because I'd like to know, but I can guarantee it's not going to be a mile and a half per gallon. That's crazy. A half mile per gallon is kind of a big stretch if all we're really doing is putting more fuel to the cylinder. Let's go to North Dakota. Tim, welcome to the program.
How you doing?
Good. What can I help you with today?
Hey, I'm bringing on a second truck, or I brought on a second truck, and my question is how can I pay this driver and not get into pulling out taxes? I just would like to pay him on a 1099 at the end of the year.
You can't.
I can do it. Okay.
Well, let me explain that. You can. Everybody else does, but it's wrong. The rules are pretty clear. The rules are pretty clear. Everybody thinks that they found some loophole or some way around the rules. All they've done is just break the rule and get away with it. And most people do get away with it. But if you're asking how it should be done, when you own the truck and you hire somebody to drive that truck, they are not an independent contractor. You can't pay them on a 1099. They're an employee. But so many people in this industry have done it for years and years, and they get away with it that everybody thinks it's okay, so everybody does it. But it's not. It's just wrong. So he's an employee, and you should be paying Social Security and Medicare and workers' comp and state unemployment, federal unemployment, all those other things you have to do with employees.
Okay. Answers that. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call. Let's go to North Dakota. Cody, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin. How are you doing today?
Doing great. What can I help you with?
I have a Detroit 60 engine on my Freightliner Columbia. It's been running great. You know, it's been a real good trouble-free engine. I got the OPS on it, so I'm doing my oil samples, All of them are coming back real good. You know, no trouble at all. 2 days ago, I was doing my pre-trip and noticed a bunch of oil on the right-hand side, right underneath the turbo. Checked the dipstick. It was half a gallon low, you know, so I topped it off. I'm wondering how big of an issue is this? It's leaking about a gallon per week. I'm getting the truck serviced when I go in for a CMC seminar coming up. I'm wondering, can it wait that long and just keep topping off the oil, or is that something I need to get looked at right now? The boost pressure seems fine. The oil pressure seems fine. The truck seems to be running as if there's no problem. I just don't want to end up blowing turbo or something to make it a lot worse.
Can you tell where the oil's coming from?
It's coming from, it looks like there's a little black box about the size of a Rubik's Cube, like right underneath the turbo, and that's where it's leaking from.
Yeah, I don't think you're leaking a gallon a week. I think that's probably a combination of what you're leaking and what you're burning. And oil leaks, for the most part, are usually just annoying. They're usually, you're not in any danger because there's plenty of oil in the engine. We should have good oil flow. I might look a little harder to see if I could determine where it was coming from and if it's an easy fix or not. But it's not going to hurt anything.
Okay, so I can certainly just keep tapping it off until I get the truck to Pittsburgh Power during the TCMC and have them do a further diagnostic. It's not going to blow apart my turbo halfway there?
No.
Okay.
No.
And then, I mean, the truck was using about the truck never smoked on startup. And shortly before this started happening, about half a week ago, it smoked on startup real bad one time. So would that lead you to think that it's starting to burn oil for some reason?
No, I would almost, my first thought, especially on startup, if you're burning oil, you will smoke all the time. You'll smoke even more under hard. Yeah, you'll smoke hard under heavy pulls. When a truck smokes at startup, I usually think injector. You've probably got an injector that's dripping when the truck's sitting. And what happens is you get a bunch of fuel sitting in the cylinder, and when you fire it up, that's when you see all the smoke because you can't burn all that fuel sitting there. Are you doing oil samples?
I am. My last oil sample was like 17,000 miles ago, and it came back, you know, a 0 or 1 or whatever the lowest one is. It came back, you know, fine. I don't have the sample in front of me, but there was nothing out of the ordinary on it.
On your next sample, you may see some fuel dilution. It may have been a one-time thing. Sometimes that happens. But if you keep seeing the smoke on startup, there's a good chance you're also going to see fuel dilution, and it would probably mean you've got at least one injector leaking. But I would wait. No big hurry. I would wait for your next oil sample and see if there's any fuel dilution or not. I'm all out of time. I've got to get out of here, but don't go away. Jonesy's up next with the all-night truck stop. You're on the road, dog. Sirius XM 128. Thanks for choosing to spend an hour of your time with me tonight. Be safe, be profitable, do the hard work, and master the journey. Good night, everyone. I'm Kevin Ruff. All right, everybody, give me just 2 minutes. I need to check something on my recording, and then we are going to come back and record another hour, so don't go away.
Your money, your taxes, your truck, your road to success in the trucking industry.
This is Trucking Business and Beyond, the show that puts the money where it belongs.
Back in your pocket.
Welcome to the program. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford. The number to join us, 8888 Road Dog. The website is letstruck.com. The show is all about the business of trucking. If you've got questions about trucks, money, fuel mileage, maintenance, tires, taxes, technology, or anything else you want to talk about, pick up the phone, give me a call. I'll do my best to get you an answer. We're going to jump right into some phone calls tonight. We are off to North Carolina. Steve, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin. Thank you for doing what you do. I have a bit of a quandary that I'm in right now. I've been with this company that I'm with for about 17 years, and I do very, very well, and I do have an element of loyalty with them. But I was offered the other day another job as an owner-operator with a substantial financial increase in my overall income. And I'm kind of in a spot here. It does not have anything to do with, you know, there would be no conflict of interest. This is not even a customer that they're aware of or anything like that, and I'm really not sure what I should do.
This is always tough when we have major life decisions. One of the things that I like to do is get everything out of my head and onto paper. So I would, and I have a method that's kind of goofy, but it really works for me. I would get two poster boards, and I would get a bunch of markers, crayons, colors, chalk, whatever. And I would just start writing on each poster board the pluses and minuses of each job. Like, you might want to split each poster board in half and, you know, write all the things you love about your current job and the things you hate about your current job or things you just don't like. Those are easier because you've been doing it 17 years. You know just about everything there is to know about it. The new one, yeah. You got to guess about some things. Certainly the money is a plus, and you might know some things about the operation, so you would list all the things you think you're going to love, because you don't know for sure, and all the things you think you're going to hate. And some interesting things happen. When you get it all out of your head, you start having new thoughts, and it helps you make these decisions, because what happens now is if we were to take your own dialogue, what's going on in your own head, the odds are you keep repeating the same things over and over and over and over and over. This one makes more money, but I've got 17 years. This one makes more money, but I've got 17 years. This one makes more money. Boy, it's a big risk leaving someplace after 17 years. And that's all you ever get to. I mean, your mind just keeps repeating the same couple of facts over and over and over, and you can't make up your mind. So get it out of your head, get it on paper, get it on poster boards, and you'll be amazed that you'll start to have some clarity and you'll start to have some new thoughts, and that might help you make this decision.
Sounds good, Kevin. Writing it down always seems to work, and I think I'll try that.
Yeah, there's no right answer. I mean, There just isn't. There are just choices, and a lot of it we don't know which one's going to be a better choice. We don't know what's going to happen tomorrow with either one of these jobs. So get it out of your head, get it on paper, put it away for a couple days, go back and look at it again, and I think that you'll start to get some clarity on this. And then some of it really just comes down to your own personal preference. For me, I like change. I like new challenges. I like new opportunities. And I don't worry too much about what I might lose. And that's another way that you can approach writing it. You can do what I love and what I hate. You can do what I'll gain and what I'll lose. And you might want to do all those things. The more you get this out of your head and the more ideas you get on paper, the better you're going to be able to make this decision. Let's go to Colorado. Nick, welcome to the program.
Yeah, hi, Kevin. How are you today?
Doing good. What's on your mind?
I got an oil sample and a transmission question.
All right. Go with your transmission question while I look at the oil sample.
All right. So I got my truck into Western Truck Parts over here in Denver. They took it apart and gave me the bad news. So now I have to put more money into the truck for the clutch and the transmission. And I'm already in the hole, and this is all debt I'll have to accumulate and eat. And that's going to be... So now I need to know if I'm going to change to from a 10 to a 13, and just it's about $2,200 more for the 13 speed. And that's
no,
my question.
Don't. Yeah, don't. You know, changing, we just talked about this last night, I think. Yeah, no, it's already out. But that you're telling me this is all debt you have to take on, and we don't like to take on debt. Sometimes we have to. But when we do, we want to minimize that debt. Now, if you had plenty of cash sitting around, I'd say go for the 13. But that $2,200 is probably going to take you 18 to 24 months to make that back. Now, you're also going to be paying an interest on it, so it's going to take even longer to make it back. That's too long when you're not in a really strong financial position. This is a time where, because the 13 speed really doesn't make that much difference. It does help us tweak a little bit on the hills, and it'll improve fuel economy a little bit if we really drive it right, but it's not worth that extra $2,200 worth of debt right now. It's just not.
Yeah.
I know it seems like, well, I've already got it out, this is the time, but it, in my opinion, it's just not a big enough difference. I mean, we were just talking about this the other night, and I think it was Steve Krohn I was talking to, says he wouldn't take a 13 speed. His 10 does just fine. Now, Steve breaks 10 miles to the gallon occasionally. That's how good a fuel economy he gets. And he doesn't think that there would be any advantage to him in the 13 speed. And there can be in some operations, but it's pretty small. See, that $2,200, there are so many other things you could spend that money on that would give you a much bigger increase. But the thing is, you don't have it to spend. You've got to borrow it, and there's no way I would borrow it for this. Put the 10-speed in, you'll be fine, and you'll be $2,200 richer right from day one.
Even though, you know, I'm grossed about 75 to 8, you know, to 80, and I'm pulling east and back.
Yeah, it would be nice, but again, you're just not in a financial position when you have to borrow the $2,200 on top of what you're already borrowing to get this repair done. I wouldn't do it. I think it increases the downside is too big and the upside isn't big enough. That's just my opinion, but that's based on knowing the numbers. I wouldn't do it. If I were in that position, I would not do it. I would put a 10-speed back in and save my $2,200. Let's go to California. Howard, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin. Thanks for taking my call.
What's on your mind today?
Well, I spoke to you about a month ago about putting a DPF on my truck or buying a new truck, and I decided to go ahead with the DPF, so I'm in the process of doing that right now. It's going to take, I guess, they put a little device on to read the temperatures of my exhaust and everything, so that's going to, they said it's going to take about 3 months before they get around to putting the thing on. So I was wondering, before I, you know, have them do this, should I stop by Pittsburgh Power and throw this truck on a dyno and see what's going on as far as that goes?
It'd be wonderful to have a before and after on this.
This way I can figure out like you said, you know, find out what was going on before and then after I put the DPF on. Like I said, it's going to take them about, he said it's going to take about 3 months to have them build the filter, and then it'll take them a day to put the thing on.
3 months to build it. That seems kind of crazy, but who knows? We have so little information about how these DPFs are going to affect older engines that the more information we can get, the better. So, if you could get it over to Pittsburgh Power and do it before and then go back and do it again after, that'd be fantastic to see the difference.
Fantastic. All right, Kevin, thanks for your help.
All right, you're welcome. Can't wait to see some results on these. I hesitate to recommend it to anybody because I just don't know, but some people are going to be the guinea pigs, so I'd like to get as much of that information back as I can. Should help us all. Stick around. We'll be right back here on the Road Dogs, Sirius XM 128.
Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. The number to join us, 8888 Road Dog. I'm going to get right back to the phones. Let's go to Arizona. Jim, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin. I got a 06 Freightliner Columbia with a Series 60 Detroit and a manual transmission with a smart shift on it. And what my truck seems to be doing over the last week or so is when it shifts from 9th into 10th, down at the bottom of that RPM range, you know, at like 12 and a half or 12 or something like that, it starts sputtering. It's almost like, you know how the old carburetor engines, when you started it up, the timing was a little bit off, and you hear that kind of like a pop in the air cleaner?
Yeah, this is really, really common on EGR engines, especially with VGT, variable geometry turbo. Something is causing the turbo actuator to not respond fast enough. Now, maybe the actuator itself, it may be V-pod. There are a couple different things that can cause this, and there's not a real easy way to troubleshoot which one it is. But what's happening is the VGT is not responding fast enough, and it's almost like it's coughing back through the turbo.
Yes.
And it's very, very common on these engines. Unfortunately, it's not always easy to figure out what's causing it and fix it. A lot of times the shops just want to throw parts at it until they get the right one, and that can be expensive.
So it wouldn't really be a good idea to just go put a new turbo on it and alleviate the – it could be something other than –
Yeah, many times what we see is the shops will turbo in the actuator, and it actually fixes the problem, but only for a couple months, and it comes back. And you can't afford to keep throwing turbos and actuators at it. But like I say, sometimes it's the V-pod, and there are a couple other components that can cause this. And this is, you know, part of the frustration with these EGR engines. When they start, you know, screwing up, there aren't that many places that know how to fix them.
Well, see, I was actually thinking it was the shifting software on the transmission that was just causing it to drop and come back and
nope.
Drop and come back.
No, because here's the thing. If we take an engine that's running properly, we could shift and we could shift all the way down to 800 or 900 RPMs, put our foot right back in the throttle, and the engine should never do that.
Right. Okay.
But it is, and it's doing it, you know, at 11 or 12. A lot of times the shops, what they tell people is, well, don't let it shift so low. Well, first
yeah.
off, on an auto shift, it's, you know, you could shift it manually, but that's just a stupid answer because the engine shouldn't do that. We should be able to
right.
put our foot in the throttle at any RPM and not get that hesitation, not get that cough back through the turbo. Like I say, the VGT is not responding, right? We just have to figure out why.
Okay, and second really quick question. And I don't want to bring up a name, but I was running through Effingham, Illinois the other day, or 6 months ago. And my truck had a governor on it, and all I really wanted to do at the moment was remove the governor so that when I got into those passing situations out in Arizona and New Mexico, I could take care of it. Guy talked me into, you know, a $300 package, which was reroute, you know, changing all the codes on everything. seemed like a good idea at the time. And yes, my fuel economy came up, and I mean it was good already, and now I'm doing better, but or I should say and, you know, I'm concerned. I've got a Detroit with 1,000,000 miles on it, 500 horsepower, and I've heard through a couple shows you've kind of hinted, not a good idea to bring your injectors all the way up like some people are telling you to.
I don't know why the people came up with this. It's not a good way to run the injectors. The engine usually runs rougher. There are so many better ways. If we want to increase horsepower and torque, there are other ways we can do it. Running the injectors straight across the board at those numbers, just not a good idea.
Well, then let me ask you a question. If I wanted to get it reversed, well, I do want to get it reversed, what is a good way of doing it? Is it going into a Detroit shop, or do you need to go to somebody that understands what you did and put it back the way it was but still keep the optimum fuel economy?
Well, yeah, you want somebody, and I'd love to say just take it into a Detroit shop and they'll know what to do, but not all of them will, and some of them may get it right, some of them may screw it up. You know, a shop like Pittsburgh Power, I certainly trust that they would get it right.
Yeah, and
I know that that's not always easy, but other than Pittsburgh Power, I don't have a lot of shops that I can recommend that I trust that much. So, yeah, it's not that complicated. If you have a good Detroit shop that you trust, they can certainly do this. Let's go to Louisiana. Phil, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin. Thanks for taking my call.
What can I help you with today?
I'm looking at a 09386P that's got a C15 motor in it. And I realize that I don't have any idea about a C15. I just wanted to get your opinion on your likes, dislikes, that sort of thing.
Okay, so C15 prior to ACERT technology, which is the equivalent of EGR, it's just a different method, great engines. After ACERT, not so much. I don't like the ACERT engine at all. The twin turbos are kind of a pain. The throttle response on that engine is horrible. Fuel mileage isn't so great. Now, on the plus side, I will say that the ACERT tends to have less mechanical problems than the EGR engines. The EGR engines tend to keep you on the side of the road or in the shop trying to get the problems fixed. And we talk about that all the time, how shops don't know how to fix them. The ACERT doesn't seem to leave you stranded quite as often. And that's my experience here on the air. And that's also from the maintenance reports that I read every year. The ACERT has slightly less problems than most of the EGR engines. What will happen with the ACERT is it tends to lose some performance, lose some fuel mileage, but it doesn't break. I mean, it keeps running. But when it loses that fuel mileage and that performance, again, nobody seems to know how to get it back. But I don't see as many problems, as many breakdowns with the ACERT as I do other engines.
Right.
So I don't like any engine after 04.
Right.
But I would say that I would have to put CAT second after Detroit in my opinion. That would be probably the second engine I would consider.
Right.
What kind of fuel mileage would you expect to get out of something like that? It's a 386-09, 18-speed with 342 gears.
Yeah, the 342s I'm not wild about. 355s would be better. 279s would be even better. You know, this will probably I'll tell you what I always tell people about emission engines. Is it will probably get somewhere between 4 and 8 miles to the gallon. And that's about the best I can predict.
Wow.
I know, it's crazy. But see, the emission engines, after 04, the engines are so inconsistent. Then when we throw the DPF on, and this one has a DPF, they get even more inconsistent. When we talk about pre-emission engines, I can make some pretty accurate estimates on what the fuel economy is going to be. On this truck, I will tell you, if everything's working right, it should be a 6.5 to 7 mile per gallon truck. It has the potential to be a 7.5 to 8 mile per gallon truck with the right modifications, driving it the right way, but that's only if everything's functioning properly, and I never know if it is. And if it isn't, don't really know what to do with that either. All right, let's go to Oklahoma. Eric, welcome to the program.
Hey, Eric. I'm sorry, Kevin. I talked to you last week about a 2015 Cascadia. I wanted your opinion on direct drive, overdrive, and gear ratios. They're able to get me a 410 horse, 1450 foot-pounds with a DT12, and they would spec it with a 250 rear end or go to an overdrive. Same horsepower, also possibly 450, and then I could get multi-torque 1450, 1650 with possibly a 308. You know, I don't know what your opinion would be on a ratio in that area.
Got it. Hold that thought. I'm going to get to a break, and we'll be right back. Stick around. You're on the Road Dog Sirius XM 128. I'm Kevin Rothberg. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. The number to join us, 8888 Road Dog. The website, letstruck.com. I'm going to go back to Oklahoma. Eric, are you still with me? All right. So one of the challenges we face with these new trucks, new transmissions, new specs available is we don't have a lot of history. Some of these things we kind of have to guess about and go, you know, on the past couple of years, what's worked and what hasn't. I don't really care for the 308. I think they're going to match that to a single overdrive, and it's going to be impossible to drive it in direct. So it's slightly better than a double overdrive, but I'd much rather see you go with even the 250s and, you know, a direct drive transmission, or do the 250s with the single overdrive. Will they let you do that?
I haven't asked that question. It looks like I got low pro tire spec at 60 miles an hour, which is where I drive. That's going to put me about 1290 in the RPM range with a 250 direct, 1250 with the 308 in the overdrive. You know, and they talk all this downspeeding and, you know, trying to get the RPMs as low as possible. So, you know, it's kind of foreign to some people because, you know, they think they need to be higher in the RPM. I'm trying to get to the cutting edge. So
they started telling us in 04 we needed to run those really low RPMs, and we did. That's why everybody was specking 336s. Now that we've got the scan gauge and fuel gauges, we're looking at it going, wait a minute, that doesn't seem to be working all that well. We seem to do better. I know the engineers told us for years and years and years, keep the RPMs low, keep the RPMs low. But in the real world, we're finding almost all of these engines are doing better in fuel economy at 1,400 than they are at 1,250.
Okay. Yeah.
So I if it were me, I would spec it with the 250, and the 250s are plenty tall. I mean, you're going to have plenty of low RPM when you want it. So we're still kind of sticking with what they're recommending. But I would go with the 250s in a single overdrive so you can run it in direct and you've still got that. What other option for rear ends will they allow you? I would actually like to come up one more from the 250s, like 264s would be better. 262s.
I'm curious. I haven't ran that number yet to see what the RPM range would be. I'm not so worried about drive of startability because when you pick a direct DT12, I mean, you've got like a 14.93:1, and I don't, like I said, I don't haul heavy either, so...
I'm sure
that's an option. I have actually seen some trucks spec'd in truck paper with 264, so that may be better for pulling. I just don't want to have 410 horse, 1450 torque, and still not be able to pull the hills at you know, highway speeds like I'd like to be. I've been in an M2 with gutted horsepower and an Allison six-speed, so spending some money on a good truck.
I wouldn't do the multi-torque. I would set the torque and horsepower as high as they would allow me, and I wouldn't do a multi-torque. I would do a straight torque, straight horsepower, as high as they'd let me set it, and I would do the 264s with a single overdrive. I think that'd be a great setup.
Okay. I appreciate it, Kevin.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call. The 250s, I just don't think it's going to let you run at 55 when you want to, and I like that option. And then if you have the single overdrive, you can run 75 if you want. It just gives you much more flexibility. Let's go to Chicago. Lance, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Kevin, I was curious. We recently added Hotshot Secret for Station Eliminator to three of our trucks. Ran them for probably about 35,000 miles. Very happy with the outcome. We noticed this time when we ran the oil samples on all three vehicles, all three had elevated lead levels with an extra. So
did you say this was a? Is this a fuel additive or an oil additive?
Oil additive for injector stiction.
Oh yeah, see that would worry me because there have been other oil additives on the market that have been proven to attack the bearings. And that's why I'm just not a fan of oil additives, because we don't know what's going on in the crankcase sometimes. And lead, I mean, unless they've got lead in the additive itself. Now, you may want to either call them or call the lab and ask them if they know if that lead is coming from the additive itself. If it is, I guess that's better than if it's coming from the bearings.
We dumped all the oil on the three trucks. We had 2 years on them. You know, not a big deal. We run bypass filtration. I just thought it was odd to be all three trucks. That was the only number out, and I figured a lot of people on this that listen to you that spoiled the oil samples wonder if anyone else had used that particular product, because that's the only thing that makes sense to us.
Right.
Now, we don't run a lot of
right.
oil additives. We researched this before we did it. We were very happy with them, but that's when it made sense. So I just didn't know if you had any other experience with it or if any of your listeners did.
I don't. Maybe somebody listening. But like I say, I would call the lab and I would call the additive company both, and I would be asking the question, is the lead coming from the additive? Because if it's not, if the lead shot up on three trucks and it's not coming from the additive, it's coming from the bearings, I would get that stuff out of there in a heartbeat.
Right. All right. Well, I appreciate it, and I think we'll look into it, and I'll let you know.
All right. Yeah. If you find out, certainly let me know. That's the kind of stuff I like to know when I'm looking at oil samples. But like I say, there have been other oil additives on the market over the years that have been shown to actually attack the bearings. And if that's what's going on here, and that's where that's lead coming from, that would be bad. Let's go to North Carolina. Charles, welcome to the program. Ooh, let me try that again. Charles, are you with me?
Yeah, I'm with you, Kevin.
There you go.
I've got a question. I've got a 06 ISX coming that it's got 65,000, 67,000 miles on it on a complete rebuild. And I'm having problems, I believe, with the turbo or the actuator. I'm going through about 3 gallons of oil within 13,000 miles. It's got a rough idle. On a light load, it pulls a hill very well. But with a heavier load, it just don't seem to pull as good as it was. Like I said, I'm losing oil. It's coming out. It looks like to be coming out the exhaust. I'm not 100% if it's soot or the oil coming out the muffler. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Okay, so around the turbo when we see that leakage, it's one of two things. It's either oil or it's fuel mixed with soot. We really need to determine which one it is because very different things will cause those. But I'm hearing something that I think is totally different than what you're asking about, though. How much oil is it using? How often do you have to add a gallon?
About every 3,000 miles.
Yeah, see, that's your bigger problem, and that has nothing to do with your turbo. The rings didn't
really
seat on this engine. You're burning all that oil.
Oh, huh. That's what I was worried about.
Where did you get? Yeah, where did you get the in-frame done?
Kenworth.
Okay.
Kenworth in North Carolina.
Okay, so they will have a procedure, and this is fairly common. It happens way more than I'd like to think it should, but it happens a lot. They'll have a procedure. You contact them. You say, look, you know, it's been 70,000 miles. This thing's still using a gallon of oil every 3,000 miles. What they're going to want you to do, most shops, they're going to want you to document your oil consumption against your fuel consumption. So they're going to want to show that every 1,000 gallons of fuel you put in, you know, 2 gallons of oil or whatever the number comes out to be, and if you're putting in a gallon every 3,000 miles, they are going to have to redo this in-frame. That's really the only fix.
That's what I was hoping not, but I was hoping maybe it was just a turbo.
No, I haven't really ever seen a turbo go through a gallon of oil in 3,000 miles. It would be everywhere. This engine just, the rings didn't seat, and it's just burning the oil.
Okay. Now, as far as the turbo not pulling as well, could that still do it with the motor, or would that be turbo?
Well, you may have a turbo issue. I don't know for sure, but that's not your big issue right now. But just the engine with the rings not seating, you will lose a lot of power because the compression, instead of, you know, fully pushing the piston down, a lot of the compression is going right by the rings. So when the rings won't seat like that, you tend to get a weak engine as well. So I would get that issue taken care of first and maybe look at what's going on with the turbo as a secondary issue right now. I've got to get to a break. Stick around. We'll be right back. You're on the Road Dog, Sirius XM 128. I'm Kevin Rothenberg. All right, a real quick heads up here. Right now, I only have one question on hold. We've got a lot of calls on hold, not a lot of questions. We need to record one more segment, which means I either need at least one and preferably two more calls. So if you're on hold and you've got a question, a comment, a topic, whatever it might be, press one, and we will get to you during this segment. So here we go. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rothbard. The number to join us, 8888 Road Dog. We're down to the final segment, so I'm going to get right back to the phone calls. Let's go to Oklahoma. Eric, welcome to the program.
Oh, Kevin, I already gave you my question, but I'll talk to you all day long.
You're right. Normally Lisa puts an X next to it so I don't go back to it again, you know, me and my ADD. So I do have a couple other calls, so I'm going to get to those first, and if I need to, I'll come back to you, I guess. Let's go to Kansas City. Brandon, welcome to the program.
How's it going?
Good. What can I help you with today?
Hey, I'm looking at two trucks. They're T600s with C12s in them. Both of them's got 850,000 miles on them, and one's got a 10-speed, and they're asking 17.5. Another one's got a 13-speed, and they're asking 21.5. And I was just seeing what he thought about it. And it's 850,000. I mean, are you expecting an in-frame pretty close to that, or what, on a C12?
No, not out of a C12. If they've been taken care of, they're easily million-mile engines and some. I mean, I expect a million and 1.1 or 1.2 million wouldn't surprise me. So I wouldn't worry too much about that. The $3,000 difference, again, if it were only the transmission, I might have to seriously think hard. I would probably settle for the 10-speed for $3,000, but my guess is there's other things that will help us make this decision. Obviously, the trucks can't be exactly the same, but if they were, then I would probably go with the 10-speed and save my $3,000 for other things. But hey, have you pulled rig dig reports on these trucks yet?
I have not.
I would do that right now. I would just, before I did anything else, I would get the two VIN numbers and I would run it through RigDig and see if there's anything in there that jumps out at us. And then after that, I would pull the ECM reports, and something in there is probably going to help us make this decision.
Okay. All right. And you were talking earlier about surging or the turbo issue on the EGR motors.
Yeah.
Is that like a surge?
People describe it as a cough or a backfire. It sounds like it's almost blowing back through the turbo. Not really a surge. Like when we see the surge at idle, Detroits are famous for kind of that weird surge when they idle, and it doesn't seem to ever really hurt anything. But that's not what we're talking about here. The VGT turbos, when you try to get into the power at too low of an RPM, the VGT won't respond, and it kind of coughs back through the turbo. Let's go to Oregon. Mike, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon, Kevin. Yeah, there's contingency coming over to the CMC from Oregon, and we're jazzed. We're chomping at the bit.
All right.
My question,
I'm excited.
Yeah, we are. It was great last year, and there's a couple more guys coming this year, so we're fired up.
Good.
My question is I've heard you recommend all-season tires for drivers, and I'm looking at that here real soon. And if the rolling resistance is the same on the all-season tires as opposed to the highway tires, what's the advantage?
So just so we're clear, we're talking about all position tires, not all season. Okay, all position tires, meaning what typically people think of as a steer tire is really an all position tire. We can put it on the steer axle, we can put it on the drive axle, we can put it on a trailer, does just fine. So rolling resistance is always number one. And so let's say we're looking at two tires. They're within a couple points of each other. One is a lug-style tire. One's an all-position. The advantage for me, multiple advantages, actually, I like the ride better on all-position tires. They're quieter. I think they handle great. And they give us the ability to rotate a tire into any position we want. We have 10 positions. And let's say we start to see a little bit of funny wear on our steer tire. Well, that might tell us that we've got a wheel bearing issue, alignment, whatever. We fix the problem. But if we can see that wear pattern, it's going to continue if you leave that tire in that spot. You might be able to save it if you move it to the other steer spot, but maybe not. You will absolutely save it if you move it from a steer back to a drive. The other thing is when you move one of these tires from a drive position, put them in the drives for 50,000 miles, then put them on the steer axle, they wear like iron. And honestly, I think they handle far better in the rain than a lug tire. And I always thought they handled really well in snow and slush. And there are a lot of people who have been running them for years.
And I would agree with you on the handling and on the wear. The problem is when you go into some states, they require chains or snow tires. And that means, doesn't that mean I'm going to be hanging iron before I really need to?
Yeah, but you know what? The odds of that happening are slim to none. And what I would do is I'd throw a set of auto socks in instead. And if you ever want to run into one of those situations, throw a set of auto socks on and be done with it. But I don't see it happening all that often.
Okay, well, that makes sense. All right, well, great. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call. Let's squeeze in another one. Let's go to Washington. Will, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin. How are you?
Good. What's on your mind tonight?
The fair tax. I like it. I like the idea of it. But how do you see it actually getting put into place? The way our government works with the lobbyists and the bureaucrats, the IRS employees would put up a heck of a fight, and all the financial planners and accountants and CPAs would, how do you see it actually working out to where it couldn't be passed in the law?
We have a very, very long, difficult road to get the fair tax passed. I don't have any illusions about that. It is not going to be easy. It's a long shot, but we've got to try. And the way that I see it happening is from the ground up, not from Washington down. Washington is never going to pass this without lots and lots of pressure from a grassroots effort. So what I tell people is learn about the fair tax, and if you like it, share it with everybody, because that's what it's going to take. More and more individuals need to know it and like it, and then we need to work from the ground up. You know, there are some great resources on the website, fairtax.org, and that whole organization is putting lots and lots of time and money and effort into getting the fair tax passed, and it's gaining ground. I mean, we are much, much closer to having it discussed even than we were 10 years ago. We're much closer than we were 5 years ago. Are we going to get it passed anytime soon? Probably not. But we've got to try. I mean, I think it is the single most important thing we could do for our country. And the best way I know of to make it happen is just to keep talking about it and share it with everybody you know. You know, they listen to the two audiobooks that Neil Bortz wrote. You can get them on audible.com, and it gives you one. I think it'll sell you on the idea. The books are so well written, you can understand it and make so much sense. But two, it gives you a lot of knowledge to be able to talk to other people about it, answer their questions, and that's really what we have to do as individuals. We have to push hard to get this done.
Well, sounds good to me. The sooner the better. All right, thanks. I'll look for those books. Appreciate it.
Yeah, you're welcome. Yeah, if you go to audible.com and look up the fair tax, I think, I don't know how many titles come up, not that many, but easy to find, Neil Bortz and John Linder wrote two of the books. One of them, the first one, explains the fair tax really well. And then the second one helps you with some of the more confusing parts of the fair tax, some of the issues that people seem to question a lot and they really don't understand, the prebate and some of those things. So the second book really helps you kind of defend the concepts in the Fairtex. The first book will help you understand them. The second book will help you to defend them better. And that's what we've got to do. We've got to get talking about this. We've got to get other people interested in it. And this has got to happen from the ground up. This has got to be a grassroots effort. Thanks for asking about it, by the way. I'm all out of time. I want to thank you for choosing to spend an hour of your evening with me tonight. I appreciate it. And I'll see you back here next time. You're on the Road Dog, Sirius XM 128. Be safe. Be profitable. Do the hard work. And master the journey. Good night, everyone. Kevin Ross. All right, thanks, everyone. We will see you tonight for the live show.